Lunch with Dil Wickremasinghe.
This is Global Village on Newstalk 106-108 with Dil Wickremasinghe, and we are broadcasting live from Oscar's Bar in Dublin Smithfield as part of the 2017 Dublin Pride Festival. So happy Pride, everybody! On Global Village tonight, meet the heroes of the Irish LGBTQ community as they share with us the fascinating history of the gay movement. And with so many recent advancements, we ask, how is the mental health of the LGBTQ community and how do our young people feel about their future? Well, these are just some of the questions we'll be asking throughout the show. Pride is the highlight of the year for the gay community, both here and all over the world. It's an annual festival that celebrates LGBTQ life and its vibrant diversity in an explosion of colour and music. And this year's theme is Find Your Inner Hero. Dublin Pride is the largest festival in Ireland, and we are delighted to be officially part of it again. As always, you can get in touch with the show by texting us here on 53106 at a cost of 30 cents. You can email us on globalvillage@newstalk.com, or you can follow us on Global Village NT, and please use the hashtag GV Pride. And tonight's Global Village is the result of a collaboration between Newstalk 106 to 108, Dublin Pride, and of course Oscars in Smithfield. Every year, globally, the wonderful LGBTQI community comes together to celebrate Pride in a burst of rainbow flags, Doc Martens, glitter, and yes, even feather boas. And thousands of marches across the world serve as a reminder to society that yes, we're still here, we're still queer, and we still deserve equality. However, amidst the euphoria that Pride unleashes every year, we mustn't forget the importance of supporting all the members of our vibrant community all year round to feel free to be their true selves, find their inner hero, and live life to the full. No doubt, Ireland has come a long way from its first Gay Pride Festival in March 1983, which was aimed at highlighting the levels of violence against gay men and women. And it came as a reaction to a ruling on the death of Declan Flynn, a 31-year-old gay man who had been killed in Fairview Park. The group of men convicted of killing him were given suspended manslaughter charges. And in 1988, David Norris, who by then had become a senator, won a case in the European Court against the Irish state over the constitutional status of criminalization of certain homosexual acts. And this led to the decriminalization of homosexuality in 1993. And then, of course, the Civil Partnership Act passed through the Dáil in 2010. And, of course, a milestone for political LGBT representation came in the 2011 general elections, which saw three openly gay TDs being returned. Then in January 2015, Leo Varadkar came out and became the first openly gay minister. And who can forget, in May 2015, the same-sex marriage referendum was passed. And in July 2015, the Irish government passed the Gender Recognition Act. The couple at the forefront of the battle for marriage equality were Children's Minister Catherine Zappone and the late Dr. Anne Louise Gilligan, who passed away just this week after a short illness. Apart from being an educator, a champion for equality and justice, I will always remember Anne Louise for being a phenomenal
hope.
Okay, is not only our country's first gay Taoiseach, but
a in hope. You can say that this profoundly
late Dr. Louise.
What are you looking at?
Of course, I'm joined by Senator David Norris, Alva Smith, organizer or co-organizer of the Feminist Open Forum and former UCD academic, and Tony Walsh, independent curator of the Irish Queer Archive and co-founder of the Gay Community News. You're all very welcome.
Hi.
You're all heroes, as you can hear from our live audience. You're hugely respected and loved by all the community. Now, let's start from the very beginning. I suppose a lot of people would think the marriage referendum 2015, but the movement started quite a long time ago, Senator Norris, and you were there.
Yes, it started really in 1974 when we started the Irish gay rights movement. And, of course, it split after a year or two because there were people like myself who wanted to progress political ends. We wanted human rights for gay people. And there were another group of people who perfectly legitimately just wanted a social outlet. So that led to the first split, the campaign for homosexual law reform, which is rather amusing because it consisted of about six people, half a drawer in my filing cabinet in Trinity, and I persuaded various people like Hugh Leonard, the playwright, Victor Griffin, the Dean of St. Patrick's, Noel Brown, former Minister for Health, to go on the note paper. And we were denounced as an international conspiracy funded by Jewish money from New York. It was absolutely fantastic. I mean, what recognition that gave us such status, if they had only known how miserable we were. But can I also say how very sad I was to hear yesterday of the death of Anne Louise Gilligan. She was a really lovely, warm, gentle, caring person, and I'm afraid that Catherine Sepold will miss her terribly.
Terribly, okay. Yeah, absolutely. Our thoughts are with her.
And it was also fun. It was immense fun in those days. Maybe later on I'll tell you a story about the first march.
Very good. We'll come to that. Alva, when did you think, the moment when you thought, oh my goodness, I need to do something about the fact that that there's no gay rights here in Ireland?
Well, see, I think I'm a little bit disappointing because although I'm really quite old, I'm sort of the same age as David.
73.
Well, 71, David.
Oh, so well, I'm older than you.
But the thing is, and I don't think that my situation was at all unusual, I didn't actually come out until the end of the 1980s, beginning of the... Well, yes, it was really the end of the 1980s. But I was, so to speak, moving in that direction during the 1980s and keeping an eye, I suppose, basically on girls, but also on the movement. I was involved in the women's movement. And, of course, in the women's movement at that time, we were, you know, there were a lot of lesbians. I was almost there. So, for example, the Declan Flynn march, that was really very, very important at that time. I knew all about David's case and was incredibly interested. So we tracked everything. But my historical memories of actively being involved in the first marches and so on that I went on were really the late 80s and the beginning of the 90s. And that was, I mean, for me, incredibly exciting. But it also felt... It was a bit dangerous. I mean, I don't know about David and Trinity, but I certainly felt that in UCD I was risking my job, and people would say things to me like, oh, they can't get rid of you because you've got a permanent job, and you basically, the only reason they can get rid of you is for obscene behaviour. But that worried me even more because I knew what they might consider to be obscene behaviour.
So, and at that time they would consider being homosexual obscene.
Yes. Absolutely, absolutely. So, I mean, I think I found them, as I say, incredibly exciting, enthralling, and personally enormously fulfilling. But at the same time, I was trying to sort of link the feminist women's movement activities I was involved in with lesbian and gay activities. And we can come back to it, but I'll finish on this point. At that time, there was really quite a split between the boys on the one hand and the girls on the other. And one of the great joys of my life is that we went beyond that. One of the very great joys that we moved beyond that in our politics. And in fact, gender is now outpacing us, so we're outpacing it. So, you know, I'm seeing so many of those really important changes around gender that marked those early years of mine in the movement.
Incredible. And of course, Tony, you were there as well. I mean, you co-founded the GCN as well. But when take me back to that moment where you thought, okay, I have to do something about this.
It's very clear. It was 1979, so I was 19, and I just finished a relationship with a woman who actually realized she was lesbian. So it was a little bit like the blind leading the blind.
So your relationship with the woman, she was a lesbian.
Well, so I came out and also got politically involved within 6 months of coming out, and it was impossible not to. It was 1979. The Hirschfeld Centre was a few months open, Dublin's second attempt at an LGBT community centre, and actually the sixth oldest in the world. At that point, and it was just, I just remember being caught up in this fervor and rush of excitement and dynamism. I mean, the lesbian gay civil rights movement would have been 5 years old at that stage, yeah. And it was impossible.
It was, that's a better mic. You can use that.
Can you hear me?
Yeah,
I can hear myself now, actually. I was just going to say that, so when I came out at the age of 19 in 1979, the lesbian gay civil rights movement was 5 years old. And there was something extraordinarily dynamic and wonderful and exciting and demanding for it. And also, I think one of the things that motivated my sense of righteous indignation and the arrogance of youth, you're 19 and everything, the conceit and arrogance
of youth. You feel invincible.
Well, not only that, but I also realised, inspired by people like David, who would have been 15 years older or something like that than me at the time, I also realised when I looked around me, one of the things that compelled me to want to take some sort of visible role in the civil rights movement was realising that there weren't people who reflected my worldview and my sort of 19-year-old sort of aspirations and dreams, or who was articulating my concerns in a way that was meaningful to me as a 19-year-old. We had just founded the National Gay Federation Youth Group, and it was almost taboo to have a conversation around not only youth sexuality, but when it came into talking about lesbian and gay youth sexuality, it was utterly transgressive. It was a really fraught, difficult situation. It really was quite extraordinary. And I want to, by the way, just clarify a misconception you made about Pride Festival starting in 1983. The parade started in 1983. Our first Pride, well, apart from 8 brave people who protested on Gay Pride Day, June 27th, 1974, which David will hopefully talk about later. The first Pride Week was held in 1979 and continued throughout the 80s. And I actually think one of the things that enabled Pride to get off the ground was the establishment of the Hirschfeld Centre, because it meant we had an economic resource and we had a human resource that made it possible for people to go out. And our first Pride demo, actually, in 1980, the highlight of Pride was a picnic in Merrion Square, where we came out with our pink triangles and our bottles of wine and cheese and crackers.
Oh, very civilised.
And then got moved on by the park wardens, who didn't want us in the bloody park. That was the highlight. But our protest, there weren't enough people to have a parade for another 3 years. Our protest was 16 of us wandering around town, giving out pink carnations. We bought box loads of them down in Smithfield, at Flowermark, giving out pink carnations and 4-page leaflets explaining the history of the Stonewall riots, and asking people, bemused and sometimes bewildered shoppers around Dublin too, to embrace our concerns. You know, but it really was. I remember at the time just feeling there's an imperative on us to get out there and be visible. And of course, that's essentially what Pride is about. It's about protecting ourselves as real life people. This is us. Take us as you will. You know, and it's from the get-go, it was always important to actually do that and to be mindful of it.
And Senator Norris, tell us the story about the first Pride.
But Rotham, I can't hear myself now. Anyway,
there we are,
yes. Well, it was in 1974. There were about 7 of us, I think. We marched up Grafton Street and we were there to picket the Department of Justice. And we all had placards. I had one that said, "Homosexuals are revolting," which is the double entendre. All the secretaries were out on the first floor.
Oh, that's very clever. I love that.
Yeah. Well, the secretaries were out with their eyes out on the stalks watching this. The 46A bus nearly went through the railings of Stephen's Green. And then a lorry drew up and the minister's new carpet was thrown out on the pavement. And the helper from the lorry got out and took one look at us and said, "Jesus, Mick, fucking queers." And Mick got out, took one look and said, "What about it? I don't give a bollocks. A picket's a fucking picket, mate." And he took on my placard. And they left the minister's carpet on the ground. And they walked around, my march around in solidarity with us for half an hour, which was really rather nice. Yeah.
Senator Norris, just be mindful of the language because it's 7 o'clock in the evening. I kind of knew this.
But I'm only just saying exactly what was said at the time. Yeah. You know?
And Albert, tell me, do you think there was a, like, obviously, was there a difference at that stage between gay men, you know, picketing and being out and being visible and lesbians? Or was it always the same?
No, I mean, I think there were real separations there. There's no doubt about it. And, I mean, I certainly, you know, in retrospect, you can say it was because of this, that and the other. But, I mean, and of course there were reasons for it. At the time, it often felt quite difficult. But I think it's also important to see that, you know, women were certainly fighting discrimination on all kinds of fronts. Indeed, we still are. Because if you look back to 1983, that was the year that the Eighth Amendment was inserted in the Constitution. And we're still fighting that today. So a lot of those struggles were going on for women. And I'm just thinking about my own case, for example. It was quite difficult to be out because I had a child. My daughter was little at the time. And I was very fearful of what might happen. And I was by no means the only only woman in that situation. So in a way, it was really important for women to kind of stick together as well. But we also had an enormous amount of fun, but it was a bit later. I can't remember because I never remember dates, but we had a couple of dyke marches. I don't know if David or Tony remember the dyke marches.
I remember being at the last ever dyke march.
Well, 97.
I remember I did the first, I was, you know.
I think it was later than 97. I think it was 2000 something.
No. This was definitely 1990s because wow. I was still very much a young woman because I was able to get out in this very tight leopard skin dress.
You can still get away
with a red, bright red wig, and this big limo went off down O'Connell Street, and that was the start of the Dyke March. But the point was, we had no permission for that march, and we were terribly worried about the guards. And the reason why we'd no permission was because nobody ever thought of going to say to the guards. And then if we had gone to the guards, what would we have said? We're a bunch of dykes, we want to march down O'Connell Street. The guards wouldn't have known what to say to us. Because, you know, when you think back, I mean, you know, just looking over at David and Tony here, it was really hard to say you were lesbian. That's a word that you've only really been able to use with impunity in this country over the past half dozen years or decade at most. And we worked really, really, really hard to overcome that, to make it okay to say I'm lesbian or I'm a dyke, whatever it was. And I still feel terribly proud of the fact that I am a real dyke, okay? I led a dyke march. I got the credentials.
Alva, it took us 4 years to actually include the word lesbian in the title of the Gay Pride Week posters, 1984, to finally actually drop in lesbian and Gay Pride Week. And it sort of shows you the sort of evolution and embrace of language and concerns. By the way, you describing those early marches reminds me of our first Pride parade. And tellingly, it was called the Gay Rights Protest March. Yes. I mean, it's where our pride, our sense of pride, was mediated through protest. I'm talking about 1983. I was one of the three speakers with Joni Crone. And we had a similar situation. Grafton Street had just been pedestrianised. And we met up at Stephen's Green, as we're doing this year. About 150 people from all over Dublin, a huge contingent from Belfast and Cork. And we decided, gorgeously sunny day, we decided, so this is Ireland's first ever, on the island of Ireland, the first ever Pride Parade, just a few months after the Declan Flynn protest march. And we decided, we're bloody well having our day in the sun. And the police were going, who's this raggle-tag bunch of heads? There's no sort of health and safety or, you know, protocols, stewardship protocols. And we decided we were going down newly pedestrianised Grafton Street. And they're going, you are not doing that. And we're going, we bloody well are, because that's where all the people are, and we are doing this. We're going from down Grafton Street, up Suffolk Street, and then we're going to stop outside the GPO. And this is 150 people, no floats or anything. And we did it, and it was just, I remember as we were coming down Westmoreland Street and just coming up to O'Connell Bridge, and you've got this a wonderful expanse of the riverscape, and O'Connell Street's ahead of you, and I'm going, we have bloody well arrived, we really have.
Yes.
And then we rock up to the GPO, and we discovered that the City Council put up a reviewing stand for the National Children's Day Parade, which is happening the next day, and us being opportunistic faggots and dykes thought, we'd be having that. and immediately decorated the reviewing stand with like all our banners and flags and everything, and then made our little speeches. And Joni Crone, Ireland's first television lesbian, she came out on the Late Late Show in 1980. She was the last speaker, and she rededicated the GPO as the Gay Persons Organisation.
just after
an angry motorist tried to drive through our little small group that were just standing in the middle, literally on the street, blocking the traffic, with the police just standing around going, well, what are we supposed to do with this?
But, you know, I just think, just listening to that and thinking, we must never forget to be bold. We must never forget that that's who we are. And, you know, I always say that to much younger LGBTQIs now, that we have this incredibly bold history, that we've always been radicals because we challenge society to rethink what it is, and that we mustn't lose that boldness and that fire and that colour and the vibrancy. So I always say, bring on the feather boas. Bring it all on. Bring on the shouting. Bring on the fact that we crash through the barriers and that we don't take no for an answer. And I worry about that now. I want to see that coming right back again. Maybe it will in this Pride. I hope it does.
Senator Norris, what do you think about the young generation of LGBTQI who are now in the process of coming out in an island that's much more inclusive and you know, with legislation that enables, you know, for us to get married and feel more you know, equal members of society? Do you feel that maybe they've forgotten our history and our past? And
well, I don't really mind if they have, you know, because I mean we were operating to remove one set of burdens, and I don't see any reason to place a burden of gratitude that everybody has to kind of touch the forelock every time they go past us.
Why not? I think it's a great idea.
I don't feel a bit like a hero. I'm a perfectly ordinary person. We took some unusual steps and so on. I always say I spent so much time pushing the boat out as far as marriage equality is concerned. I put down the first ever civil partnership bill and so on and so forth. But I spent so much time pushing the boat out that I forgot to jump on. The next thing I saw was going out beyond the harbour, little figures waving at me, sitting on my fanny on the strand. But the reward, as far as I'm concerned, with regard to young people, it's always difficult to be an adolescent. For many, many people, very few people sail through the bodily and emotional changes of adolescence without damage or without difficulty and anxiety. That's heterosexual and homosexual as well. But the reward for me is seeing, as I did over the last 2 months, two lovely, handsome, athletic young men walking across O'Connell Bridge hand in hand. That's the payoff.
That's a beautiful sight.
I think we do still have, I mean, there is still an enormous amount of work to be done with and together with young people and with old people as well. Maybe I would think that because, you know, this is something that is approaching for me. And I don't think we've given that very much thought either in our community. But I also think, you know, that we do have the gender recognition bill now for trans people. But that is absolutely not to say that this is all sorted and that it's really easy to be trans in Ireland today. I don't think it's that easy at all.
There is a most extraordinary acceptance of the whole transsexual issue and agenda. I mean, I'm astonished by the attitude, the speeches, and the behaviour of my colleagues in Leinster House.
Well, that's
I mean, they've taken it on board fully and they're pushing it. It is fantastic.
And now
it's an enormous change.
We have to give some reality to that too, though, in terms of actual services and provision. But you know, David, attitudes change in all kinds of ways. So we've had that massive change, the sort of the official change has occurred, but now there is all that legwork still to be done.
If I look at when I ran for the presidency of Ireland in 2011, the utterly unprincipled, vicious and dishonest homophobic campaign was mounted by virtually every section of the media against me. But I'm very glad to be able to tell listeners to News Talk, I think I took 8 or 10 libel actions. I've won every single one of them. So the apologies were on page 32 in tiny letters, but I've got the money in my bank, and anybody who says the same kind of disgusting things as they said about me during the presidency, well, I welcome it, because they'll be coughing up more money.
Very good.
You know the way Dave has been talking about there's no need for a duty of burden on the part of baby gays.
Baby trans.
But I've often seen my sort of our role as advocates for change and as political agitators, as something like a tag team, that we run as fast and as furiously and as compellingly as we can, and we know when it's our time to actually pass the baton on to somebody else and to say to them, now it's your turn. To know when it's very important for us to know, especially for people who work in the voluntary NGO sector, because you see burnout all the time. And this isn't just about sort of LGBT civil rights; it's across the sector. But I'm always mindful of our responsibility to empower other people to take that baton and then run with it as far as they can, and in their case to know when it's the time to pass it on to somebody else.
That's true.
That's part of our sort of intergenerational dialogue. It's part of the responsibilities we have and the duty of care we have to each other across the generations.
But it's not your time yet, Tony, to be passing it on, okay?
I hope not.
I have no intention. I mean, I'm happy to share my tag with loads of people, absolutely of all ages, because I mean, I think that the sort of the old young sort of those barriers that we put up are also very stupid, frankly.
Very quickly before we run out of time. No,
you get launched on that one.
I know, it's great.
Perhaps better not.
I have to ask you about a lovely new Taoiseach, gay Taoiseach. Any thoughts? What do you think? I'm sure you're all very much from a point of view of being he's conservative, but the idea of having a gay Taoiseach, is that going to influence young people coming out?
That's a very good question, because in a way I think, you know, David, you're absolutely right. There's been such a kind of a sea change in that regard that I think people kind of take that bit for granted, okay?
But it does
mean that we think of him as having had a particular kind of experience and therefore being open to further changes.
Well, I mean, in my day, there was absolutely no role model at all for gay people. Now, a young person growing up gay can look at Leo Varadkar and say, well, I could be Taoiseach too. And I think that's absolutely superb. He's a good man, yeah. Too. I wouldn't share his right-wing politics at all. I'd be very much to the left. But there were two good candidates. Leo is clear, firm, decisive. And when he was taking legislation through the Senate, this was long before I knew he was gay, he was always in full charge of the brief.
Yes. Okay, well, we've run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. My God, I know I'm not supposed to call you heroes, but come on, you guys are awesome. So that's the Senator David Norris, Alva Smith, co-organizer of the Feminist Open Forum and former UCD academic, and Tony Walsh, independent curator of the Irish Queer Archive and, of course, co-founder of GCN. We love you. You guys are amazing. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you guys.
I'm not queer. I'm old. I'm a fairy. I am not queer.
Thank you, Senator Norris. So